As America begins the celebration of its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum thought it would be appropriate to create our own recognition of this important milestone. Welcome to Vashon 250, a look back at what was happening in America 250 years ago and comparing it to what has happened over the past 250 years of American history, what is happening in our current political life, and how these ideals and events have been reflected in the history of our own Vashon Island. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Hallman.
Thanks, John. Our approach to Vashon 250 during this 250th year of the United States of America as an independent nation uses the Declaration of Independence as an aspirational mission statement, the Constitution as a working user's manual, and the events of the American Revolution as a guide to help us understand who we are as a nation, how we came to be who we are, and how Vashon Island fits into this larger narrative structure.
Today, we are looking at the May 29th, 1765 Virginia Resolves. The Virginia Resolves emerged as a pivotal moment in the growing discontent of the American colonies against British rule. The legacy of the Resolves extends far beyond their immediate impact on colonial protests. These resolves are often viewed as a foundational moment in the development of American political thought and the evolution of the principle of self-determination. The Virginia Resolves contributed to the development of a concept of, quote, no taxation without representation, something we still hear today, a rallying cry that it would resonate throughout the Revolution and later become a fundamental principle in American governance.
The Virginia Resolves were a series of resolutions passed on May 29, 1765 by the Virginia House of Burgesses in response to the Stamp Act of 1765, which had imposed a tax on the British colonies in North America, requiring that material be printed on paper made in London, which carried an embossed revenue stamp. The act had been passed by the Parliament of Great Britain to help pay off some of the debt from its various wars, including the French and Indian War, fought in part to protect the American colonies. The resolves, primarily authored by Patrick Henry, stated that in accordance with long-established British law, Virginia was subject to taxation only by a parliamentary assembly to which Virginians themselves elected representatives. Since no colonial representatives were elected to Parliament, the only assembly legally allowed to raise taxes would be the Virginia General Assembly.
And similarly angered, legislatures in nine other colonies later sent delegates to a Stamp Act Congress in New York that was held October 9 through 25, 1765. Their intent was to devise a unified protest against the tax. On May 29, 1765, Patrick Henry made one of his famous speeches before the House of Burgesses to encourage the passage of the resolution. Henry said, quote, Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I his Cromwell, and George III. At that point, Henry was interrupted by cries from the opposition. May profit by their example. If this be treason, make the most of it, unquote. So, Bruce, when have similar resolves been issued during the past 250 years?
Well, a number of times over the last 250 years, groups have come together to sort of, you know, articulate their displeasure with the federal government or with the state government. And of course, one of the most important was the Seneca Falls Declaration of Sentiments, which was passed in 1848. At the Seneca Falls Conference. The Declaration of Sentiments, also known as the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments, is a document signed in 1848 by 68 women and 32 men, 100 out of some 300 who attended the first women's rights conventions to be organized by women. Held at Seneca Falls, New York, the convention is now known as the Seneca Falls Convention. Principal author of the Declaration was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who modeled it upon the United States Declaration of Independence. She was a key organizer of the convention, along with Lucretia Coffin Mott and Martha Coffin Wright. According to the North Star, published by Frederick Douglass, whose attendance at the convention and support of the declaration helped pass the resolutions put forward, the document was the grand moment for attaining the civil, social, political, and religious rights of women. So the Seneca Falls sort of declaration ends up being very much for the women's rights movement, for the suffrage movement, and ultimately for the move for women to have the vote, the suffrage movement, a sort of basic declaration of independence, and is very much in a tradition of the Virginia resolves. And of course, the Declaration of Independence itself grows out of the Virginia resolves. Many of the specific complaints in the Virginia resolves end up in the sort of complaints in the Declaration of Independence. And as I mentioned in an earlier show, it's well worth going back and rereading the Declaration of Independence. It's really two documents. The first part is a very general statement about rights, but then it lists a whole set of grievances against the King of England. And those grievances are really what are driving that sense of what the Declaration is. We want our independence because the King is doing this, this, and this. So it's a very specific document in that sense, and well worth rereading, particularly in these days when we have similar kinds of concerns about our own government. So, John, not all declarations of sentiments are quite like the Virginia resolves or quite like the Seneca Falls resolves. Maybe you can talk a little bit about Lincoln's House Divided speech and how that becomes a call to action.
It's interesting to reflect on this important speech from June 16th, 1858, the Dred Scott decision, and Lincoln talks about, quote, a house divided up against itself cannot stand, unquote. It really is a call to a civil war before it's all said and done. You do it my way or the highway. And he goes on to say, I believe this government cannot endure permanently, half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the House to fall. But I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other. Either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it is in the course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward till it shall become lawful in all states, old as well as new, north as well as south. That's a pretty powerful statement, and we know where it ended up.
Yeah, and it ends up in the Civil War, because essentially, you know, as Lincoln said, a house divided cannot stand, and essentially the South was unwilling to give up slavery. The North was unwilling to allow slavery to expand, and essentially, as Lincoln said, ultimately become extinct. And it set up battle lines, political battle lines, in the late 1850s that erupted, particularly after Lincoln was elected president, and began the Civil War. So, you know, it's not a resolution in the sense like the Declaration of Independence or the Virginia Resolves or the Seneca Falls Declaration, but it's a clear statement of where this nation stands.
And it's a very powerful statement, and to think that just 3 years later, we were at war that lasted for a long time and did remarkable damage. It's a very, very powerful commentary on President Lincoln.
It is, and it's also a powerful statement of what ultimately leads to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which sort of established the sense that slavery is outlawed in the United States, that everyone is a citizen, at least male at that time, and ultimately extended to all citizens. But it's a very powerful sense of how we move from a divided nation, divided over slavery, after a very bitter civil war, into a nation that became reunited over the idea that essentially articulated in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal. And of course, that's been the struggle for the last 150, 160 yes. years, is how do we live up to those standards?
So if we jump ahead 100 years from Abraham Lincoln, you have a letter from Martin Luther King in Birmingham.
Sure. The letter from a Birmingham jail by Martin Luther King in April of 1963, sometimes known as "The Negro is Your Brother," because that's the one of the phrases he uses in the beginning of the letter, is an open letter by Martin Luther King, who was imprisoned at the time in the Birmingham jail as a result of the Montgomery bus boycotts. And in it, so Martin Luther King makes an argument that we all have a moral responsibility to break unjust laws, going back to that sort of Gandhian idea of passive resistance, and to take direct action rather than waiting potentially forever for justice to come to the courts. And we see that today with protests against National Guard troops and ICE troops in American cities. It's sort of, at what point do you get off the sidelines and get engaged in the struggle? And of course, Martin Luther King's, one of his most famous statements in that letter is that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. The letter was written while he was in jail as a result of the bus boycotts that began when Rosa Parks sort of refused to move to the back of the bus. And it was published widely. It became an important text for the American Civil Rights Movement. And the letter has been described as one of the most important historical documents penned by a modern political prisoner, and it's considered a classic document of civil disobedience and the American Civil Rights Movement.
So using his call for unity, we saw, a new tradition of civil disobedience, be it sit-ins, protests, what have you, that took place in the late 60s or mid-60s forward. Through the Vietnam era. For some of us who were younger, we watched the Vietnam War on TV with Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather and others. But then we saw local protesting really kind of get up ahead of steam. And we see that again now. So Bruce, speak to that, if you will.
Yeah, I think what Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail is just a very articulate call for civil disobedience. And what was fascinating to me is that what you saw as a response to that is a group of young black people, essentially in North Carolina, who begin a set of sit-ins against lunch counters, against segregated lunch counters. And what's significant about that is it brought young people into the civil rights movement. And what you saw was the emergence of things like SNCC and CORE and these sort of civil rights movement organizations that were not dominated by the older black sort of clergy of the South, like Martin Luther King. What you saw was the emergence of newer, younger, often more militant young black leaders who took over the movement and moved the movement onto the streets, into the lunch counters, and a very sort of public confrontation with the system of segregation throughout the South. John Lewis emerges as one of those leaders. And so what you see is a transformation taking place. And then that's, of course, picked up by other rights movements. You have the Native American rights movement and the sit-in at Wounded Knee. You have an emergence of a yellow wave movement, the Asian Pacific rights movement that picks up and begins to militate against anti-Asian kinds of laws and regulations. And you see that throughout the United States. And so that 1960s, 1970s becomes a period of sort of revolutionary change. there's not often the violence that we associate with the American Revolution in terms of armies, you know, fighting each other, but there's violence all throughout those movements, you know, from, you know, the murder of young civil rights movements in Mississippi to the fire hoses in Birmingham, Alabama, you know, to, you know, the lunch counter sit-ins, people being attacked. And then you move to the anti-Vietnam War sort of protest. And many of those same kinds of tactics, those same kinds of approaches, that same kind of nonviolent civil disobedience is used to protest the Vietnam War. And it begins to become a standard for how we approach protesting the acts of the United States government. And we see that right now today in the kinds of things that are going on in American cities as we confront the changes brought in by the current administration to traditional practices of policing and control and border control and immigration, and how that begins to break the norms, if you will, of American society, of how local policing is often controlled and often sort of put into practice within American cities. And so this sort of idea of civil disobedience that's expressed by Martin Luther King sort of develops a life of its own, and it becomes a very important part of modern American protest, particularly beginning from the 1960s and 70s on. And it's part of what we see at the core of what's happening right now in 2026, as we see people resisting and opposing actions of the federal government in cities and enforcing immigration restrictions.
So the Virginia resolves were based on a feeling of overbearing by the British government. And the colonists didn't like that. They wanted to fight back, and this was how they did it. Let's skip ahead 250 years and what we see today in our local versus federal policies and how they're carried out. We have National Guard being dispensed to our communities. The locals aren't happy with that. We have ICE showing up with masks on. We're not happy about that. And we have non-cooperation with local police by the feds. And nobody's happy about that. And if we now take it a step further, it was less so back in the revolutionary period, but we also have a lack of cooperation with the courts. So we get into some serious constitutional questions. And I will clarify, I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV, but it does. I have read the document, and it starts to call into question a lot of things here.
Yeah, I think you're right, John, and that's what's so important about this moment of time that we're in right now. You know, the Virginia resolves were all about overreach, you know, sort of the colonists seeing the government in London sort of going beyond what they saw as their basic fundamental rights to determine their own taxation structure. And they saw the British government overreaching and sort of overpowering local colonial legislatures, which had traditionally levied taxes, and leveling these taxes against the colonies without their consent. Well, you know, it's easy to take that philosophical position and jump it forward to the four things that you mentioned. Right now, you know, National Guard has very seldom been deployed in American cities. It has been at times of extreme sort of tensions, but that's been unusual. And now it's going on not just in one city, but in multiple cities. The idea of ICE becoming a sort of private police force masked without identity and in unmarked cars is just flies in the face of sort of local police procedures. The lack of cooperation with local police, and then the lack of cooperation with the courts, or stonewalling, if you will, the courts.
Yeah.
I mean, those four things together take me right back to the Virginia resolves, right back to the what we will talk about in the future is the Stamp Act Congress, And that whole lead up to the American Revolution, where colonists were saying, hey, wait a minute, you're going way beyond your authority as the government in London. We have responsibility for our own government.
So now that we've got our listeners revved up a little bit here, let's look at our local island community, because we have kind of our own version of all of this that's taken place over the last 100 or so years. And it ranges anywhere from all of the different districts we have, the Firewater Park, Cemetery, Airport, Hospital, the 1974 King County Rural Designation. We are unincorporated King County, and we don't really control our destiny. We pay our taxes, but we don't really control our destiny.
And we don't even get to control how those taxes are levied. I mean, we do in a sense, we elect representatives to the King County Council. We elect representatives and senators to the Washington State Legislature. And we have a vote in sort of statewide election, governor and, those kind of things. But in a sense, government on Vashon Island, we don't get to make our own decisions. In the instances that you did mention, where we do have local sort of political entities, like the Parks District or Water District or the Fire District or Cemetery District, the Airport District, the Hospital District, they all have taxing authority, but they don't have decisions over larger sort of issues on the island. They do within their narrow sort of sphere of control and sphere of influence. But they don't make island-wide decisions. Many of those areas, like water districts, for instance, only cover certain parts of the island. It's been an interesting way to look at Vashon. We've always been what I like to call a vassal state of King County and the state of Washington and of the federal government. Significant overall decisions for Vashon Island are not made on Vashon Island. They're made in Seattle at the King County Courthouse, they're made in Olympia at the state capitol, or they're made in Washington, D.C. At the United States government level. They're not made on Vashon. And that has been an issue since the very beginning. Vashon has had a whole series of attempts to break away from King County. A number of times we have tried to become an independent county. We've never been able to get it through the state legislature, but there have been attempts. And then the ultimate sort of slap in the face to me is in 1974, when King County worked with the state legislature to designate Vashon as a rural district under the State Growth Management Act, which meant that Vashon could never incorporate as a city. So the one sort of avenue that we had to control our own destiny, to be incorporated as a city, was taken away by the state of Washington with the compliance of King County and the encouragement of King County. And so we're sitting in a situation where we can never sort of control our own destiny. We can never become an incorporated city, and not that I think we should, but the option should be there. And we basically are dependent on the county, the state, and the federal government to make decisions for the island.
Well, and there's the 1974 work, and then in the 90s, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but in the 90s there was another effort made to become our own community.
Right.
And it would have required a feasibility study from the county, and they didn't allocate the money.
Right.
So essentially, our hands were tied.
Yep.
And ultimately, we were left in the situation we are now. Interestingly, I went down this rat hole recently just mm-hmm. to see what the whole story was. It's amazing how many of the people that were involved in that decision on either side mm-hmm. are still around.
Right.
And maybe they'll write to us at our email and give us thoughts on that, and maybe we'll get them in here sometime to talk about it. But it's clearly the deck was stacked against the island, and I hold out hope that someday maybe we'll be able to come up with a definition of a township, because that's the one thing that doesn't have a clear definition. So Craig Bellis, wherever you are, we're going to bring you in sometime.
Well, that's an interesting thought because, you know, the townships are not well defined in the Washington State Constitution. So that's certainly a way to go. There's also the possibility of becoming a port. You know, so if you think about the Port of Seattle or the Port of Tacoma, but also Kent is a port city because there's a little narrow piece of land of Kent that goes and touches Puget Sound. What you've got is the ability of the island essentially to become a port district, which gives us an overall sort of governmental voice. Now, again, you need to step back and ask yourself, do we really want to
really
be
the
that?
Right thing? Yeah.
You know, what are the consequences? And let me tell you a good sort of case study of why not to do it is to look at Bainbridge Island. Bainbridge Island used to be unincorporated Kitsap County. The city of Winslow, which was the little port on Eagle Harbor, where the Bainbridge Ferry goes from to Seattle. In the 1990s, I believe it was, Bainbridge incorporated as a city. So the whole island became, and the city of Winslow joined together and incorporated as the city of Bainbridge Island. And it was disastrous for the island. What happened was certain development interests came in, won elections, took over the city council, and basically began to pass regulations that led to sort of untrammeled development around Eagle Harbor and on many parts of the island. The very thing that the rural designation by King County under the State Growth Management Act keeps Vashon rural. And so, you have to sometimes question what you wish for. It may not be what we want. But we need to be able to make that decision ourselves, not have it imposed.
And having a viable study to take a look at what the cost would be, both financial, physical, whatever, would be wise to do if we could ever get to that point. But it all kind of comes back to having a voice and being told what you're going to do and you don't want to do it. And so we fight that even to this day. Next time on Vashon 250, we're going to take a look at the Stamp Act Congress. We talked about the Stamp Act itself, but now we talk about the Congress. Bruce, fill us in, if you will, about what next time brings.
Sure. I mean, all of these shows are building chronologically. So essentially what you see happening with the Stamp Act in 1765, and then with the Quartering Act, and then with the Virginia Resolve, ultimately lead to the calling together of multiple colonies to join together and hold what is called the Stamp Act Congress. And essentially, it's the colonies joining together to do what Virginia did in the Virginia Resolves and protest against what they see as unfair taxation by the British government in London. And what's so important, we'll come back and talk about this next time with the Stamp Act Congress, it becomes a model for the Continental Congress that a few years later comes together and writes Declaration of Independence and declares themselves independent from the government in London and begins the American Revolution.
Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Vashon website at voiceofvashon.org. Go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. That's vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a presentation of Voice of Vashon, your island connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.